Thank you very much, Rhoda, for that very generous introduction and very thorough. It's a great pleasure to be back at Tufts. As I recall that day, President DiBiagio, that was it was raining that day in graduation in 1976. But it's a pleasure to be back here, and I want to thank you for your very kind introduction, too, and welcoming remarks, Dr. DiBiagio, and I really appreciate the openness that you have had toward my presence here today. I think you represent a rare combination these days in academia, and that's an abiding commitment to excellence along with an understanding of the lives of students and faculty. And I think this combination has helped make Tufts the enviable institution that it is today. I first met General Galvin in the 1980s when he was the Southern Commander in Panama, responsible for U.S. forces through Central and South America. And I don't have to tell you that also General Galvin served with distinction as the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe before becoming the Dean of the Fletcher School. And I think his presence here at this university and in this position illustrates one of the special and unique traditions of our American experiment, a tradition which goes all the way back to our first and perhaps greatest soldier statesman, George Washington. So it's an honor to be here. I mean, in our republic, old soldiers don't fade away. But like General Galvin and some of the other generals named Marshall and Eisenhower, they become great statesmen. And that's because in a democracy like ours, the best soldiers are always statesmen from the beginning. And I think that is your story. American leadership in the 21st century, perhaps even more than in the 20th century, will require just the sort of mutual understanding and close teamwork between soldiers, statesmen, and scholars that is embodied by General Galvin and by the Fletcher School itself. Because the Fletcher School's mission is creating wise foreign policy professionals, a mission which we'll be increasingly grateful for in the complicated world that lies ahead. Some of you are probably old enough to remember the drills in school where you had to put your head beneath your desk in the event of a nuclear strike from the old Soviet Union. None of the students here, but some of the professors might remember that. I remember when I was about 9 or 10 years old, I used to have my own, I had a design of my own bomb shelter. And in that bomb shelter, I had identified where I was going to put my cot, where I was going to put my favorite books, and where I was going to put my basketball. See, the premise was, even after nuclear holocaust, there would be basketball. Well, I'm not sure that such precautions would have made much a difference. But the reason I mention such ancient history is that for 50 years after the end of the Cold War, and after the end of World War II, and until the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, we were sure about one thing. We knew where we stood on foreign policy. We were against the Soviet Union and all that it stood for. We were against communism, Marxist-Leninism, and totalitarianism, and the repression of freedom. And we were right to be. For 50 years in America, we always knew what we were against. But the challenge today is a little different. We need to figure out what we're for. In life, it's always easier to be against something than for something. And we see that in politics from time to time. But today, when it comes to foreign affairs, things are not so clear. The world's a more complicated place, and it's no longer divided like it once was into good and evil, clear enemies, obvious friends. The choices are no longer so stark, and stark choices are the easy ones. We're at a time where I think we need to take stock, a time where we need to see around the next corner, a time where we need a new vision. The post-Cold War period doesn't even have a name yet. In some ways, it is still too new to put a handle on this era. But in other ways, there are things that we see happening, patterns and developments, that are as clear as day. We need leadership that is looking ahead to the world that we will be living in, rather than behind at the world from which we came. Too often these days, our policies, even our military, are designed for a world that no longer exists. The world today is a very different place than it was only 20 years ago. Globalization and technological change have brought us all closer together. Satellites, cell phones, the internet have changed the very concept of distance. Borders are more imaginary than ever. From a laptop in your living room, you can rove around the globe in an instant. For example, I have a friend named Chidambaram, who was the finance minister of India a few years ago before there was a shift and the Hindu National Party came in. And we were having a conversation one day, and he was telling me about when he was up campaigning in his district in central India. And he was walking up and down the street, shaking hands with people, as politicians do. And he walked into a little tea shop, and he was served a cup of tea by a 13-year-old boy who was obviously the son of the proprietor. And he asked him, "Oh, son, what do you want to be?" like politicians sometimes do. And the boy said, "I want to go into computers." He said, "Why do you want to go into computers?" He said, "So I can be like Billy Gates, the richest man in the world." The point there not being wealth, but that whatever was happening at Microsoft on the shores of Puget Sound in the state of Washington in the United States of America had traveled 14,000 miles around the globe and ignited the imagination of that young man in a tea shop in central India. We live in profoundly different times. There are 2 billion more people in the world market today than there were only 10 years ago. Interest rates right here in Boston are set by millions of individual investors all around the world that make a judgment about the United States every day. We're interconnected in ways that even poets never imagined. And in so many ways, this new world reflects our own values, as countries everywhere learn that free markets demand free minds. A company that I have admired the way they think about the future is Shell International. And what they do in thinking about the future is they don't predict the future, but what they do is put together disparate talents and try to create a story about different futures to see how each would interact in those moments. And a few years ago, they came out with a study, and they concluded that there was only one economic model in the world. And it was a model that rewarded prudent fiscal policy and open markets. And they asserted their T is I no in alternative, A. T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. In other words, we live in a world of TINA. And those who understand the rules and play by them do very well. The United States in the last decade. Those who either resist the rules and their authority or ignore the rules don't do so well. Indonesia is an example. And so this is a world that is different than it was 15, 20 years ago. It will be increasingly different as we move ahead. But it's a world in which America can excel. I've come here today to talk about how I see that new world and where America and all of you fit in. I've been thinking and writing and speaking about foreign policy for more than 20 years. I remember in my first years in the United States Senate, I was assigned to the Energy Committee, and the chairman was Scoop Jackson, who became a kind of a mentor for me, and he gave me the job of thinking through the geopolitics of oil. Of course, that was at a time when there was an oil disruption, prices were skyrocketing, people were waiting in lines for gasoline, anger was high, and we were basing our entire policy on dependence on foreign oil. And the answer that policymakers came up with was to build a massive syn fuel corporation that would create oil from shale and tar sands at great environmental cost. In thinking the problem through, it became clear to me that it wasn't dependence on foreign oil, Mexican oil, Venezuelan oil. It was rather dependence on oil from insecure sources, such as in the Persian Gulf. And that the way to deal with the problem was not to build a massive syn fuel plant, but it was to deal with the issue of insecurity. And that meant building up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve of the United States so that when there was a disruption, we would be able to continue to function as an economy. As I looked into this and found that the oil reserve wasn't being built up, I made further inquiries in my position on the committee and found that the reason that we weren't building the oil supply up was that the Saudi Arabians didn't want us to. And I thought that was counter to our national interest. And so I began a process and introduced amendments with then-Senator Bob Dole to increase the amount of oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I also sought to go to Saudi Arabia and sat down and had a conversation with the oil minister then, Sheikh Zaki Yamani. And in that conversation, I asked him, is it true that Saudi Arabia does not want the United States to fill its Strategic Petroleum Reserve? He said, that's true. I said, well, what will you do if we do fill the reserve? He said, we're going to have to cut some of the oil. And I said, well, get ready, because we're going to fill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And we came back and passed the amendment, and now the reserve is nearly full, 60 days supply, and we're a more secure nation. Out of that early experience as a United States Senator, I derived four lessons. One, define the problem right. Second, decide what to do about the problem, and then act decisively. Third, seek bipartisan support. And fourth, no appeasement. It was a very important lesson for me as a young senator. In the mid-1980s, I was asked in another area on the Finance Committee, I was asked by then the head of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade if I would sit with six other people from around the world and essentially conceptualize the trade round that became the Uruguay trade round. We met for a year, year and a half. We came up with a program for negotiation that became the basis for the Uruguay trade round. That was 1983-1984 when the report was released. The Uruguay trade round began, and over three administrations and four or possibly five trade representatives, the negotiations took place. On the Finance Committee, we interacted on a regular basis in terms of overseeing those negotiations. And then there was finally an agreement in 1995, and it was ratified by the United States Senate. Now, that was 12 years of my life devoted to one project. So the lesson that came out of there is have a clear vision of where you want to go, develop a strategy to implement that vision, and then stay with it over time. Visions aren't realized overnight. It takes time. For many years, I, as I've illustrated, thought about foreign policy from the standpoint of the United States Senate. Now I'm thinking about it in a different way. A president has a singular role when it comes to foreign policy, for only he can lead. The next president must be able to help America and all Americans navigate in this new world that I've described. That in itself won't be easy. A president also has some very basic and fundamental things that he must always manage. You might call it the president's job description. He must first protect our national security, maintain our leadership in the world, and talk honestly with the American people. That is always the president's job. But in this new world, the next president has an even heavier burden, which is to try to create a comprehensive framework for peace, security, and prosperity. That's not only in the interest of America, but everyone, everywhere. And it's not simply an American project, nor is it something we can impose on the world like we were able to do after World War II. We can help mold this new international system, and it will emerge from international institutions, new and old, from partnerships and alliances whose resources and efforts are going to be essential. It's not anything we can do by ourselves, for its very nature is cooperative. This is one of the big and essential jobs of the next president, and it's one we must do well. This new world that's taking shape is not always clear. For example, there's a disturbing paradox. We are more powerful than ever before, yet we're also more vulnerable to a variety of threats. The great risk of nuclear holocaust with the Soviet Union has receded, but there are a multitude of smaller threats, from troublemaking dictatorships like Iraq, to the poorly safeguarded nuclear warheads in Russia, to the increasingly dangerous situation on the Korean Peninsula, to transnational terrorists who view the U.S. as their number one enemy. As a result, the next president must have a few principles to guide him to manage these new threats and new opportunities. He must understand how to protect our security in response to our growing interconnectedness. He must have a policy countering small threats so they don't grow into larger ones. He must maintain a strategic stability in the world that prevents the start of a new and deadly arms race around the world. He must gear our policies to the world as it is, not the Cold War world that no longer exists. And finally, he must understand our deep American attachment to human rights and that our values and our interests are very often one and the same. Well, that was a whirlwind tour of the horizon, and I'm sure you're already relieved that I'm not going to give a long speech amplifying each of these points. Instead, I thought it would be a lot more interesting for all of us to have a conversation about foreign policy. I'll answer your questions as candidly as I can and tell you what I think. But I also want to hear what you think. Too often when it comes to foreign policy, there's no dialogue, and instead candidates simply give a speech to inoculate themselves on the issue and then forget about the whole thing. That's not what I want to do. By the way, there's another thing that some of you here may remember, and that is that once in America, there was a consensus in Washington about foreign policy. Men and women of goodwill in both parties joined together to do what was in America's best interest. There was an old saying that political division stopped at the water's edge. Sadly, that consensus has vanished. Foreign policy has become more a political football, or is made through polling or focus groups to score domestic political points. I deplore that. And one of the things that I will try to restore if I become President of the United States is a bipartisan foreign policy consensus. That's in all of our interests. Indeed, doing what I'm about to do today, answering questions on foreign policy, trying to speak plainly and honestly with you about foreign policy is one way of moving ourselves toward just such a consensus. For it's essential for a president to be able to be frank and direct with the American people on foreign policy. To lead, the president must have the support of the American people. And to get the support, he must always be straight with them. While the president sets foreign policy goals with his vision of the future, it's all of you in this room today and all around this country, as well as dedicated foreign service professionals around the country and the world, who are going to do the hard work of trying to make that vision a reality. You'll be on the front lines, and all America is grateful for that. So, without further ado, let's talk about foreign policy.
All right, as you can imagine, we want to make the best use of this time as we possibly can. So there are a few rules. You won't be surprised that I'm trying to organize things. There are a couple of microphones here, so if you have a question, use the microphone, first of all, so that it can be picked up by the media and by the whole room. Second, state your name and your affiliation. Then don't make a speech. Don't take up somebody else's time. It's a question period. Let's get some questions, and let's give as many people an opportunity to do this as we possibly can. Don't line up more than about three behind the microphones. Let's try to keep it from being a long, long line. But you get an opportunity, and we'll have quite a few minutes here, I hope, that we can go ahead with questions. And the senator would like to pick his own people. And, sir, I'll turn it back to you again.
Thank you very much, General Godwin. Let me tell you, I like to do questions. I'll recognize you. You ask the question. If I don't know the answer, I think it's stupid. I'll go like this. You sit down. I'll call the next person.